Good evening and welcome to the November 2025 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Morelia. We start tonight by introducing you to the new executive director of Face to Face, Kevin McAllister. Raif Durazi will have this month's HIV roundup, and then Finn Dearhart sits down with Rick Miller, a psychotherapist, public speaker, and interesting podcaster. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, November 23rd, 2025. This is Greg Morelia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of November 23rd, 2025. U.S. Catholic bishops this month formalized a ban on gender-affirming care for transgender patients at the denomination's hospitals across the country. The prohibition, approved overwhelmingly by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops at their meeting in Baltimore, Maryland this month, came in the form of revisions to the ethical and religious directives that guide thousands of Catholic hospitals, clinics, and providers across the country. The updated guidance was based on previous doctrine issued by the Vatican in 2024 and U.S. bishops in 2023. In the 2023 publication titled, quote, Moral Limits on the Theological Manipulation of the Human Body, end quote, U.S. church leaders told dioceses that Catholic health care services must not perform interventions, whether surgical or chemical, that aim to transform the sexual characteristics of the body into the opposite sex or take part in the development of such procedures. This month's revised guidelines formalized that directive. While Pope Francis expressed support for transgender faithful, and Pope Leo has indicated he'll follow his predecessor's lead on the LGBTQ+ community, the Church remains formally opposed to the act of transition and the concept of gender fluidity. Bishop Robert Barron of Minnesota told his colleagues during the discussion, quote, with regard to gender ideology, I think it's very important the Church makes a strong statement here, end quote. According to the Catholic Health Association, more than 1 in 7 patients are treated each day at Catholic hospitals across the United States. And they said in a statement, quote, Catholic providers will continue to welcome those who seek medical care from us and identify as transgender. And they went on to say, quote, we will continue to treat these individuals with dignity and respect, end quote. And in the state of Ohio, resident William Saki recently attached a license plate reading gay to his Honda sedan after winning a lawsuit against Ohio's Bureau of Motor Vehicles for unfairly blocking him from getting it. The Bureau of Motor Vehicles had told Saki that his license plate was, quote, inappropriate, end quote, but Saki says he's proud of his new plates. He said, quote, gay is who I am. It's a fact, and I am proud of it, end quote. In September, a federal judge ruled that the Bureau of Motor Vehicles violated Saki's free speech rights by denying his license plate application for the words gay, queer, and homo, even though the Bureau allowed him to apply for license plates reading straight, straight power, no gays, and no homos. The Bureau of Motor Vehicles also rejected an application for license plates reading Muslim, though it accepted applications for atheist, Baptist, Sikh, and Hindu. Following the ruling by the judge, Bureau of Motor Vehicles representatives agreed that they would approve any of the 62,000 forbidden words in their database that don't meet the standard of being offensive, disparaging, or socially insensitive. They added that the Bureau will provide information to drivers on how to appeal an inappropriately rejected license plate. And last Thursday was this year's Transgender Day of Remembrance. And a stark new report from Advocates for Equality reveals the extent of the violence, erasure, and institutional abandonment confronting transgender Americans. But it also highlights the resilience of a community determined to survive it. The 2025 Remembrance Reports documents 27 violent deaths of transgender and gender nonconforming people over the last year, and 21 deaths by suicide, a devastating pattern that has become all too grimly familiar. 61% of transgender people lost to suicide were between the ages of 15 and 24, a finding the report connects directly to the dismantling of youth protections and the loss of crisis resources such as the LGBTQ-specific 988 suicide crisis line ended by the Trump administration last June. Trans women of color continue to be victimized at an alarmingly high rate. The report found that 15 of the 17 transgender women of color killed this year were black, underscoring a pattern that has persisted for more than a decade. Gun violence accounted for 17 of the 27 violent deaths, including the killing of Washington, D.C.'s Dream Johnson, a black trans woman who was shot after men reportedly hurled anti-transgender slurs at her. The report also highlights a deep distrust between transgender communities and law enforcement. According to the U.S. Transgender Survey, 62% of respondents said they were uncomfortable seeking help from police due to their gender identity. Those fears were reinforced by cases like those of Linda Becerra Moran and Rick Oster Newman, both of whom were shot and killed by police this year. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. Our first guest tonight is Kevin McAllister. He is the new executive director of Face to Face, Sonoma County's premier agency supporting those living with HIV and helping to prevent the spread of the disease through education, awareness, and much more. Kevin McAllister previously led Meals on Wheels in Sacramento County and has held executive leadership roles at the Rainbow Community Center, California Youth Coalition for Youth, and other organizations serving vulnerable communities. With federal funding for HIV work being cut by the Trump administration, Kevin's got his work cut out for him. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And more importantly, welcome to Face to Face. I think it's fantastic that the organization is doing what it is doing and seems to be thriving. But before we get talking about Face to Face and your vision for the organization, tell us about your background and how you ended up in Sonoma County.
Yeah, so I'm actually from Solano County, so I spent a lot of time in Sonoma County, specifically Guerneville, vacationing with family as a kid, and fell in love with the area. So as soon as I could move out here, I did.
Awesome. Where in Solano County were you?
I was in Fairfield.
I worked at Fairfield Police Department for 10 years.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, awesome. And lived there as well. So you probably were... You are significantly younger than I am, but probably went to the school system there and a lot of the places that I certainly knew about.
Yeah, I went to Armijo High School. Okay. And also I worked for Fairfield Susan Unified School District for years.
Nice.
So, yeah. Awesome.
Awesome. What did you do for the school district?
So I worked in, I was an instructional assistant for special education programs. In addition, I ran AmeriCorps at Solano Community College.
Okay.
And so I spent a lot of time at the various school sites supervising AmeriCorps members that were providing early childhood education literacy support for kids K through third.
Awesome. Well, gosh, I've got a lot of different directions I want to go here, but you know, when you're not doing all your work, what do you like to do in your spare time and for fun?
For fun. I love archery. And I mean, honestly, just chilling in the woods. So I live in the Redwoods in Casadero. So,
well, you really did fall in love with West County.
Oh yeah. And every day feels like a vacation. That was the goal. It was to move somewhere where every day I woke up and felt like no stress. And so I just spent a lot of time relaxing and hiking. And, you know, I live next to Goat Rock. I'm about 10 minutes from Goat Rock, so I go to the beach daily just to relax.
Beautiful. Yeah. That is a gorgeous area, that's for sure. Well, how did you get into HIV work? Let's jump into that.
Yeah, so I started doing outreach in 2009. So I did outreach in Sacramento. I was handing out, you know, condoms, lube, and actually doing testing in the community, working with CARES in Sacramento, and really enjoyed working with the community.
And tell us about CARES. Is that like an organization like Face to Face?
Similar. You know, back then it was really, you know, focused on, you know, HIV testing and outreach. And they have, I think now they're more like a federally qualified health center, I believe.
Okay.
But again, this was 15 years ago.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
I know for me what drew me to do work with face-to-face specifically and to do HIV testing was witnessing a very close friend of mine go through the testing process and being treated horribly. I mean, so much has changed in terms of how organizations approach. What did you find to be satisfying? I don't know if that's the right word, but what called you to do the testing piece of it? I'm always curious to know about folks who get involved in this work. What drew them to be involved in that? Because that's a pretty intimate experience with people.
It is. You know, for me, it's about people knowing their status. Mm-hmm. And I've actually you know, heard horror stories from friends as well. And I've been in social services my entire life. And so I always go out into the community and just meet people where they are, you know, being open, understanding, and just showing up for people. And the testing process is nerve-wracking. You know, back in the day, getting tested, what was the time period? Two weeks.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That was rough, you know, to wait 2 weeks. And so, you know, and for me, I've lost family members and friends, you know, to HIV. And so that's what also called me to do the work, to really, you know, get out there, do the outreach, and just normalize, you know, taking care of your health.
Yeah. It's so important. And the way that it's done is also important. I'll just share this quick story with you. I took my friend he got a call from someone who said, "Hey, I just tested positive." It was a partner that he had been with. And he said, "You should get tested." And so we knew nothing about HIV, really. We should have, but didn't. And we ended up going down to the old Berkeley Clinic. I don't know if you've ever been there, but at the time, this is 2004. It's an old, old, old building with the green walls and the metal chairs. It felt a bit like an asylum, is the way I describe it. And the whole atmosphere was very cold. And so he went in, he had his blood drawn, and then we had to wait 2 weeks, and then we had to go back and get the results. And literally, they called a number, and he went in, and they told him, and he was positive. And then they said, "You should go talk to your doctor," and that was it.
Wow.
There was no handoff. There was no information. There was no, what does this mean? There was no, what are the next steps? There was no, how should I take care of myself now? Nothing. And so he was left devastated by that. And that experience for me is really what motivated me to learn how to do this right. And then to always show a level of care that he didn't receive with anybody that I encountered there. And I think that's one of the things that face-to-face has always done so amazingly well.
Agreed. And I mean, I was actually introduced, I didn't share that part, you know, during COVID, I did get tested at face-to-face.
Okay.
And the team was incredible. I actually donated after my test because I was so impressed by the team. Mm-hmm. You know, during a time where people didn't want to meet you face to face, right? During COVID, they brought me outside, did the testing, talked to me about all the services that they offered, and I just love that they really do care about every single person that comes through that door, whether they need testing or, you know, referrals for other services. They go above and beyond.
No doubt about that. Well, this is an extraordinary time to be taking on the executive leadership of an organization dealing with HIV and AIDS in particular, because all the federal funding and the federal support is being cut right and left, probably faster than you can keep up with. Talk about how this is impacting us locally.
Yeah, it's rough. You know, we're all looking at, you know, how do we continue our services with all of these cuts. You know, even at face-to-face Sonoma County, we provide housing for people living with HIV, you know, case management, food services, you name it. And so, you know, one of the funding sources that is at risk is for that program. Mm. And we would lose nearly $500,000 if the program is cut. And there goes support for, you know, hundreds of folks that we serve here in Sonoma County.
I think there's this sense that HIV is no longer an issue. And of course, face-to-face came about at a time when lots of men were dying in Sonoma County. I mean, many of them came from San Francisco and they chose to come to Guerneville and places like that, really to live out their final days. And so face-to-face was one of the first organizations to provide the essential care that people need in their final years, because there wasn't really anything that you could do.
Yeah.
But there still isn't a cure. And so the need for things like education and prevention and support still exist. And so how are we going to do that when the federal government has pretty much decided that they don't have an interest in HIV anymore?
Right. And that's, Oh my gosh.
That's probably sounds like a job interview question.
It does. And it feels like we're going backwards. And HIV is still out there. You know, we're still testing folks and, ensuring that people that do test positive have the care that they need to live healthy lives. That funding, it just can't go away.
So what kinds of, you mentioned the support for housing and the financial funding for that, but you also get money to do things like provide tests for people for free.
Yes.
What about the funding for things like that?
Yeah, that also is at risk. So yeah, all of the services that we provide in the community are free. So we do our HIV testing for free. We do our hepatitis C testing for free as well. And all the other items that we provide, so condoms and lube and, you know, all other supplies needed, you know, for safe sex.
And I think it's important for the community to know, too, it's not just at face-to-face that you provide this information. I know you have partnerships with Santa Rosa Junior College. I also know you take care of our Pride Center at Napa Valley College. Lori was good enough to come out, and we have a supply of HIV tests that we can do for students. Believe it or not, there's not a lot of places to go and get tested in Napa County, period. They don't have a face-to-face like this.
It's hard to find.
It is.
Spaces, and you know, you want to go to a place that is in the community where you are treated with, you know, respect and love and care, you know, versus going to a hospital, you know, for these types of tests.
Right. I remember a lot of people would come in and they would say that they had health care. They could have gone to their doctor. They could have gone to Kaiser for a test, but they didn't trust their own doctor or they didn't trust Kaiser. And, you know, from my experience, Kaiser's been pretty supportive in this region. But that's an important point, that having a place to go to get confidential and anonymous testing with someone who's knowledgeable about specifically HIV and prevention is really important. That's not something that maybe you're going to feel great about going to your doctor over.
Oh, absolutely. And like when you go to a space where people understand the community and understand, the need and the challenges, and you feel like it feels, when I went to face-to-face, I felt like I was home. And that's what I needed to feel when I was taking, you know, that test, is, you know, feel supported and grounded. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like you get that, you know, in other spaces, for sure.
So talk about your vision for the organization now. We've talked about the financial challenges. We still don't have a cure for HIV. There's still a need to provide education, prevention, and care for folks. Talk about your vision for this organization here in Sonoma County.
Yeah, my vision is that we are, you know, we're the go-to in Sonoma County for education on HIV, STIs, and so on. You know, we're needed in the schools. We're needed everywhere in the community to really meet people where they are, to share. Like, this is still out there. It hasn't gone away. And also the other resources that are available. I can't tell you how many of my friends don't know about PrEP and DoxyPep and all other types of medications that are available to help prevent the spread of HIV, which is, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, coming from, you know,
I mean, there really are more options than just condoms available to folks. And learning about that is one of the things that you can benefit from that maybe your local care provider isn't going to be as knowledgeable about, for sure. You mentioned education in the schools, and I know that there are some groups that continue to be at pretty high risk for new HIV infections. They experience a higher rate of new infections than gay white men do. And those young people, 13 to 24, always hits me as being surprising. It doesn't sound like we're doing a good enough job in schools around STI discussions in general, but HIV prevention specifically. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I remember when I was in the sixth grade, we actually had classes. Was it sex ed? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that that still happens. And, you know, school, that's a space where you're learning all of these life skills. And I feel like when it comes to STIs, when it comes to your health, that's a life skill that we should be teaching in the classroom. And we don't have to be graphic when talking about these things. There's a way to do it that is educational, supportive. And, you know, you want kids to ask questions. Right. You want them to truly understand how to take care of themselves, you know, their bodies and their loved ones as well. And
I think one of the important things too is to demystify the whole testing process. I mean, the stigma around HIV and the fear that comes with it, I think, is still there. If there hasn't been education, at least it's there in myth, right?
Right.
One of the things I try to do with my students at the college is do a demonstration of a test to show them it doesn't involve blood. It's very much like a COVID test in terms of how it works. And it's quick. It's 20 minutes. It's not 2 weeks. And then to sort of demystify that whole testing process time, it's just important because we want people to feel comfortable that if they feel that they've had an encounter where there's some question that they should go and get tested, and that it's not this awful situation like I described at the Berkeley Clinic.
And yes, and that's what you want. I mean, I remember my first test, and it, you know, they ask you all of these questions, and, you know, then I actually had someone say, like, why did you do that? And don't you know better? And, you know, things like that that don't right. belong in that space. Because that'll prevent people from coming in and doing routine testing,
right?
Which is what we want. We want people to know their status. Yep. We want people to get connected to care. And we want people to know about, you know, safer sex practices, again, for their overall health and wellness.
Right. Well, it sounds like community support for face-to-face is going to be more important than ever. Where can people go to learn more about face-to-face if for whatever reason they're not aware of it, but more importantly, where can they go to provide some financial support and get a tax write-off?
They can go to face-to-face.org, and it's F2F.org to donate and support our programs and services.
Perfect. And if you missed that website, I'll put it on our website at outbeatnews.com. You can just click on show notes at the top of the page. Go check out the website. And more importantly, drop by the office and see what is available there. I think it's especially important if you are a member of this community that you know what's available to you. Go check it out if you haven't been there.
Yes, please stop by.
Awesome. Kevin McAllister, thank you so much. Best wishes to you in leading this fantastic organization, and know that you've always got a place here to share information here on Outbeat Radio.
Thank you.
And now, here's Raif DeRozzi with this month's HIV News Roundup.
Welcome to the HIV News Roundup for November 2025. This month, we saw major breakthroughs at EACTS, or the European AIDS Clinical Society Conference, the end of the U.S. government shutdown, serious warnings about rising deaths in Europe, and promising progress in long-acting prevention, all against a backdrop of tightening budgets and widening inequalities. One of the hardest-hitting stories this month came out of EACTS. New regional data shows that more Europeans are dying of HIV now than 15 years ago, rising from 37,000 deaths in 2010 to 51,000 deaths in 2022, a 37% increase. The sharpest rises are in Eastern Europe, including Russia, Ukraine, and several Balkan countries. Researchers pointed to four major drivers. Late diagnoses. Many people still present with CD4 counts below 200, one of the prerequisites for an AIDS or late HIV diagnosis. Ongoing injection drug use epidemics, with inadequate harm reduction. Political instability and war, especially Ukraine, disrupting ART access, and underfunded public health systems, slowing viral suppression progress. It's a stark reminder that biomedical tools alone cannot counter structural collapse. This year's EACTS scientific program delivered some of the most consequential research updates we've seen in 2025. Highlights include a new investigational once-weekly PrEP pill that demonstrated strong drug levels across the full dosing interval, good tolerability, and significantly higher adherence compared to daily pills in early phase work. If it maintains efficacy in larger studies, this could fill a gap for people who want long-acting options but are hesitant about injections. Researchers refining the reactivate and kill approach towards a potential HIV cure presented the clearest mechanistic data yet. These next-generation strategies use more selective latency-reversing drugs, combine them with advanced immune-based therapies like engineered antibodies and CAR T cells, and sequence the treatments in a way that minimizes toxicity while sharply increasing the odds that reactivated HIV-infected cells are actually eliminated. It's incremental, but it's real progress towards an approach that can be safely tested in larger cohorts. Early data on ultra-long-acting antiretrovirals showed sustained drug levels past 6 months. Researchers emphasized potential annual dosing, but stressed the need to study reservoir penetration and equitable pricing models early, not after approval, when access gaps are already entrenched. In a historic moment, Eswatini became the first African country to receive the twice-yearly injectable lenacapavir for HIV prevention. About 1,000 initial doses were delivered, roughly 500 for Eswatini and 500 for Zambia. Eswatini, which has one of the highest HIV incidence rates globally, aims to use lenacapavir to reach some of its most vulnerable populations, including pregnant and breastfeeding women. There's real promise on the pricing front. Under voluntary licensing deals, lenacapavir is expected to cost around $40 per person in 120 low and lower middle-income countries, beginning in 2027. That price could dramatically lower the barrier to long-acting prevention in highly affected regions. While lenacapavir made headlines, it's not the only access story this month. Uganda announced a national scale-up of multi-month ART dispensing, now offering 6-month refills to most stable patients. Vietnam reported that community-led PrEP programs continue to outperform clinic-based models, with retention rates above 88%, especially among men who have sex with men and trans women. Brazil expanded its national PrEP program to include transmasculine people and non-binary communities, explicitly for the first time. This month showed that access gains are happening in places that invest in community leadership, not just new biomedical tools. When the longest U.S. federal government shutdown ever ended earlier this month, HIV programs across the U.S. began the process of digging out from the disruption. It created an immediate backlog across key systems. CDC surveillance reports were delayed, HRSA grant processing and Ryan White payments stalled, and many community clinics had to front costs for medications, labs, and staffing without knowing when reimbursements would resume. These delays didn't shut services down necessarily, but they strained already thin safety nets, especially in states where clinics operate month to month and rely on timely federal disbursements to maintain ART access, PrEP programs, and case management. At the same time, House Republican budget proposals released this fall outlined structural changes that would indirectly but significantly affect people with HIV. The most consequential proposals would tighten or cap Medicaid eligibility, putting coverage at risk for many low-income adults with HIV who rely on Medicaid for antiretrovirals, viral load monitoring, and chronic disease management. Also, roll back Affordable Care Act premium subsidies, which would cause substantial increases in insurance premiums for people who purchase marketplace plans, including many Ryan White clients who depend on premium assistance. And shift more healthcare costs to states, which could destabilize ADAP, or AIDS Drug Assistance Program, budgets, in states already seeing rising enrollment and higher drug prices, raising program costs, and increasing the likelihood of wait lists, restricted formularies, or reduced wraparound services in high-burden states. This month made clear that the biggest immediate HIV risks in the U.S. are tied to health system financing and political volatility, not biomedical science, and that coverage instability can erode progress even when treatment and prevention tools are strong. Even amid rising deaths in Europe and the challenges in U.S. HIV funding, the developments this month show that progress is shaped as much by systems, leadership, and accountability as by biomedical breakthroughs. Thanks for tuning in. For more in-depth coverage, you can follow me on YouTube at Raif Darazi.
And we'll be back with more right after this music break.
Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back. back to sleep. It's time to trust my instincts, close my eyes and leap. It's time to try defying gravity. I think I'll try defying gravity, and you can't pull me down.
Can't I make you understand? You're having delusions of
I'm through accepting limits, 'cause someone says they're so. Some things I cannot change, but till I try, I'll never know.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Outbeat News in Depth here on KRCB Radio. I'm Greg Moralia. And, of course, that was Defying Gravity by Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande from Wicked, part two of which premiered this month. You've got to see it. It's great. Okay, our next guest is Rick Miller. He's dedicated his 40-year career to motivating people to change and inspiring them to find optimism inside themselves. Through his work as a psychotherapist, public speaker, podcaster, workshop presenter, interviewer, and author, he helps individuals, couples, groups, and others connect and thrive together. And here's Finn Dearheart with his conversation with Rick.
Rick Miller, welcome to Outbeat News.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Finn.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're here. So Rick Miller, for our listeners, Rick Miller is an author, a psychotherapist, a hypnotherapist, and the founder of GaySonsAndMothers.org. And I'm really excited for Rick to be here because I really feel passionately about all the work that Rick has done. And also I'm really excited for you all to be able to hear him speak directly about his experience. How about you tell us a little bit, Rick, about Gay Sons and Mothers and what got you started and why that's a passion project for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So Gay Sons and Mothers indeed is a passion project for me. And we could say it all started with my own mother. Mm-hmm. I knew I was her favorite, or at least I made myself her favorite. And I was kind of obsessed with my mother when I was growing up, her style, mm-hmm. her clothes, things we did together. And as an adult, I had an epiphany one day when I was looking at a photo of she and me when I was like seven, which was, oh my God, I was loved so mm-hmm. profoundly by her. And that's part of why I'm healthy. And I just felt so lucky to have grown up with that. And as you said, I'm a psychotherapist. So over the years, I would pull in mothers with their gay sons if they happened to be in town visiting or when something was going on and we could use her help. And what I realized during these sessions is that the magic that I had with my mother was more of a universal thing, that many gay men have this profound experience. And I wanted to capture more about this and share it with the world. So what I thought I would do was write a quick article about gay sons and their mothers and the bond and how special it was. And to get me up to speed, I decided on the early days of Instagram to contact a few strangers. This is even before I met you. And I spoke to a couple of sons and mothers separately on the phone just to understand what their relationship was about. And within 4 minutes of speaking to them, their bond was so profound that I thought, I need to do a documentary movie. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know nothing about documentary movies. So to think that I was going to do it, which I knew I was, and that I would actually pull it off is incredible. And I did. And you were at the screening in San Francisco a few weeks ago, which was incredibly exciting. Mm-hmm. And so I won't stretch this out too long, but I got movie cameras, I got training from a videographer, and I started filming people all over the place. And I met you at a conference, for example, and you volunteered to be interviewed. And I went to your apartment and interviewed you and your partner and got incredible footage. And I have been all over the United States meeting incredible people, hearing profound stories. And it's a powerful relationship. And sometimes it's filled with love and respect. Sometimes it's filled with immense loss and disappointment. Mm-hmm. And I think especially for gay men, it's expected that we are close and enmeshed with our mothers. So when it doesn't happen, it feels like a huge betrayal to some people.
Mm-hmm. I love that last part. I want to come back to in a second. There's so much that I want to talk to you about. I just really could just go on and on for hours.
Yes, we could.
I didn't realize, Rick, that you wanted to make the documentary and that you started doing it yourself. Like you didn't have a team. You just started like learning about filming.
That's right. I did. And it was torture. In fact, I can sit down and do an interview with anyone and be totally fine. You know, as a therapist, you learn how to do that. But I would literally feel the sweat dripping down my body as I was filming with people on my own. Once I forgot to turn on the microphone, sometimes I worried that the lens cap wouldn't be on. I didn't set up the tripod right. I made so many mistakes. When I went to San Francisco and filmed you, you lined up a videographer friend of yours to do it. And it was a whole other experience. So it was around that point where I decided I'm done doing it myself. And from then on, I hired professional videographers. But some of the footage that I did on my own was so good content-wise, not professionally, that a lot of my footage is actually in the movie. So I made the cut.
That's right. Probably like cut that out. I almost like started cursing. I have a potty mouth, so it comes out.
Oh, okay.
That is so exciting to know. I didn't know that you had done that. I didn't realize that whenever you filmed me, this is back in 2018, that was a turning point in how you acquired material.
Yeah, because it was so much easier to just show up and have fun. And one of the things that happens for me when I do interviews, I fall in love with the people that I'm with. And it may be the subject matter. It's spoken about so little. There's no literature on the topic. There's no research, no nothing. And I did a research study, which I'll tell you about. But as people begin talking about their children, their gay kids, or gay men talk about their mothers, frequently they are so emotional. It's so profound, so deep, so unexplored, so misunderstood that I'm in these deep, powerful, amazing spaces with people, sometimes talking about the most primal, beautiful relationship that they've ever had in their life.
Yeah, the very, I mean, I'm really, I think it is something that for me personally to know that like I spent time inside this woman's body, you know, is it that's to remember back as a little kid why part of why I think I was so entranced with my mother too. I have a father that wasn't very he was violent with me. and I felt like my mom was the only lifeline that I had. You know, and I definitely did have a lot of identification with her. You know, I wanted to hang out with her. I wanted to be near her, doing all the things she was doing. And I know that working with gay men and sex counseling, that a lot of guys have that experience. And I'm curious what you think about this, as it relates to men trying to find a way to identify with father figures in the world, but having such a profound relationship with their mom and like coming up, like it just kind of gets kind of all baked into their queerness. And curious if you have any thoughts
Well,
about that.
in an ideal world, a child and an adult would have the privilege of being close to both of his parents. That it wouldn't be one or the other, it wouldn't be having to choose. So many gay men grew up and grow up feeling ashamed, disenfranchised, not fitting the bill of masculinity that their communities want him to be. And sometimes it's conscious, sometimes it's deeply unconscious, but it's still there. So I think the resonance towards mothers partially is due to being protected, hopefully, having similar aesthetic interests, and identifying with her in ways that are just kind of built in. And for many gay boys and gay men, they don't relate with their fathers. Studies have shown that fathers can sense that their son is different. And as you said, sometimes they're abusive, sometimes they ignore him. Frequently, they favor other siblings over the gay one. I knew in my family that I couldn't compare with my brother, who was straight A student, jock, the apple of my father's eye, the oldest male in the family. So the power that I had was saying, "Mommy loves me best." And you know, it's kind of sad that that was my only power. Maybe there was a little more power in other places, but I did not appreciate how much my father loved me until he died. And I don't think it was his death. I was in my late 30s. I think it was my own evolution and maturity that helped me realize that even though I may not have been the exact boy that he would have wanted, he loved me so profoundly and so deeply, and always let me be myself, but I didn't see it. And before he died unexpectedly, but he was having surgery and he knew that he was going to die. And he said to me, "You are perfect just the way that you are. Don't change." And that was such a profound conversation. And I was like rolling my eyes and like, "Don't say this," you know, because I didn't, I felt as though he was being melodramatic. And then 3 weeks later, he died. So I'm so grateful for that conversation and other conversations. He wasn't threatened by my relationship with my mother, which made it a little easier. I've met with many people whose fathers were competitive and
Totally.
resented the closeness that they had with their mothers, which is a real shame.
Well, I didn't realize that this piece about your father was part of your journey. How old were you whenever he told you that?
Probably, I think he was, I was 38, he was 64 when he died. And ironically, I'm now his age. And at the time, he seemed so old. You know, he had grandchildren and he
Totally.
was retired and all these things. And I'm like, "Oh my God, how did that happen?" But it
Yeah,
does.
it does happen. One thing, so I saw the film. So I'll be listeners, we will talk at some point in the future about how to see this particular film, but Mom, I have something to tell you. Is the name of the film. And I was really moved by one of the mothers in there, particularly because it was similar to some of my upbringing in a religious family, and she had grown up in a religious community, I think it was Mormon, and decided I'm not going to reject my son, and had to start making some sort of internal would initiate a process for her by which she would, I guess, partition the religious stuff and part out. I mean, it ended up being a vehicle for her of growth as a person.
Yes.
And how that connection might show up. And if you've seen that with moms,
I've,
like having
I've seen
to
it.
Choose, you know,
yeah,
like, I'm
I
not
mean,
going to choose to reject my son. I'm going to have to turn my back on everything I've known, which has to be a tremendous thing and sacrifice for her.
So this was an amazing mother who left the Mormon church after realizing that the church was not going to support what she was doing, supporting her gay son. And by the way, she's a great performer. And she said, my car is so gay, because she had bumper stickers all over her car. But around the time that I met you, I just had access to more and more people who grew up in religious families all over the United States, where it was so hard to reconcile having a gay child with what they were taught in the community. And I grew up in the East Coast in a privileged family, and not that it was always accepted, but there was less of a consequence. And mothers, what I've found in this work is that mothers intuitively, intrinsically know that their sons are different. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they knew he was gay. Sometimes they didn't know that he was gay, but they knew he was different. Right, and a good mother feels a sense of protection over her son. And sometimes it's the fathers that she would have to protect from the son, or many times it was the communities that they were involved in. And I've heard many, many sad stories about mothers, some who stayed and rejected their children, some who left in order to support their children, but they lost a big piece of who they are as a result. There's a group of Mormon mothers that started out about 7 years ago called Mama Dragons, and it was a small core group in Utah. And now they have expanded to thousands of members from all religions worldwide. Look them up, Mama Dragons. They're fierce, they're amazing. And mothers are so insecure. Am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? Is it my fault? And previously there was no information and very little support for moms. So the fact that there are now venues, PFLAG, of course, is one of them, Mama Dragons, there are so many others. There are places where mothers can go and be supported, and they are so grateful to have the opportunity to be listened, to be understood, to be reassured that they're doing things okay. Mm. Is that your end of sirens or my end of sirens?
That's sirens in Boston.
Oh, okay.
Rick Miller is coming at us from Boston today.
Yes.
Where there's sirens. I am moved by that, what you shared about that group in Utah, and also just the idea that a mom, and I think, I mean, I'm jumping into some conjecture here, but I'm curious what you think. It's like, you know, if a mother is in a spiritual community, which, you know, spiritual communities serve all kinds of needs. It's not just necessarily someone's access to whatever they feel spiritually inclined toward, but there is a support system, right? Versus the experience of actually having a child, which has to be undeniably heroic and spiritual, I mean, giving their bodies over that actually could die in childbirth, and just the whole process. And I've talked to women about that process, and I'm just entranced hearing their stories. And their, you know, this is something that, like, at this time that we're in politically, it's such an important topic in general, you know, and kind of centering a mother's experience. So that's moving to me. And yeah, I'm curious if you have any thoughts about that, about how she might choose the child versus a spiritual community because of that connection that's undeniable,
so,
that she always had.
Yes. And I mean, there's so many things I want to say. Sometimes I think about the fact that my mother gave birth to me and that I was not always a separate entity, and what it must feel like as a mother to birth a child. I mean, I cannot even imagine. I know how much I love my dogs, but they don't come from me. So you were just putting word to that. I was kind of struck by that. The other thing I was thinking about in these political times is that mothers really need support, because one of the jobs of mothers is to protect their children. And I hear this and see this time and time again, that mothers come to me fearing that they can't give enough protection to their child. And the truth is, you can raise a healthy child, emotionally healthy, hopefully, but you can't protect him. He has to go out and live in the world. But with the current political climate, mothers are freaking out, understandably so, and it's frightening. Mm-hmm. But you also touched on a point which is came across in our research. So our research was very basic. We have maybe 70 interviews that I've done over the years, and I had volunteers watch the videos and rank what they thought the most important themes were regarding the power of the mother-son relationship. And one of the powerful themes is that mothers feel a need to protect their child, and no matter what, they will do that. So even though mothers know that they're going against their communities, frequently they've been silent and quiet with their spouses, with their schools, with their churches to protect their child. They don't tell anyone. And it actually feeds into the power of the bond. That's one of the salient points that came from our research. I was trying to figure out why is this bond so powerful? And what came through these videos is that he knows that he's different, the son, and feels ashamed about it. And they have their own areas of interest, a mother and a son, and she protected him in certain ways. And she worried about him because she knew he was different. And that combination together is what creates such a powerful bond. And interesting that men are so threatened by gay men or threatened by women. So gay boys are made fun of. Mothers of gay men are blamed for making their kids gay. And unfortunately, this rich, powerful, beautiful relationship is made fun of and overlooked. And so I see my mission to share this and share the power of it with the world. And I'm just one person, started the nonprofit Gay Sons and Mothers, and it's slowly turning into something bigger. And it's such a joy to feel the appreciation from other people because it's a passion project. And as a psychotherapist, I frequently get thanked for the work that I do, and I don't really know exactly what it means or what it is. And with this, people are so grateful. Mothers are calling me out of the blue, asking me for advice. I thought I would have more gay men following me, but they have Grindr, so they don't need me as much. Mothers need me more.
Right, and gay men usually think that is therapy.
Yeah, well, right, at least for the moment.
Like, Well, I actually, there's so many things I want to talk about. I really don't know that we have the time for all the questions that are just coming up for me now, but pretend this to be like an opportunity for us to maybe speak more in the future. But
yeah,
I'm
love
curious,
to.
What else, what would you like the listeners to know about this project, how they could support it, how they might be able to see the film,
how
I might have something to tell you?
So the one thing I would like people to know is hopefully what you and I have discussed, how profound this relationship is and that it should be honored and shared and appreciated. Mm-hmm. So the organization that I founded, the nonprofit, is called Gay Sons and Mothers. We have a website, gaysonsandmothers.org. We are on Instagram, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, Gay Sons and Mothers, all one word. And if you go to our website, you can find the film, which is called Mom, I Have Something to Tell You. Currently, we're in the film circuit doing festivals. So until we're done with the festivals, probably spring 2026, it's not available to the general public. Once I'm done with the festivals, we are making plans to distribute the film, to get it out there in the world, to let it be a help in school systems, in community centers, wherever people want it. I would love it to be. So it'll be some time. So please follow us. And as soon as it's released in the public domain, I'd love to share it.
Yeah, I can't wait for people to see it. It's a really moving film. I have seen it because I was blessed to be able to go to the screening. And also for the listeners, we might be discussing about how we could get a screening going in the Bay Area in the near future. I'm curious, last question for you, Rick. What do you see, if anything, is the direction of the future for this project? Because I know it's evolved as you've gone along. Do you have any inklings about what it might become after the film circuit is done and distribution?
Yeah, I have tons of dreams. I mean, my One dream was just that I would have the film. So check, got that done. Mm-hmm. I would love to see the film go into mainstream communities and just mm-hmm. be a resource. That's the little dream. I don't know what will be next. I may just do something on mothers of all queer kids and families and expand mm-hmm. the project. Mm-hmm. Partially, it depends on what people want. It was my mission in doing this project to look historically at mothers and sons. And so that I've done, and I feel good about it. I got a lot of resistance from people about why I was only focusing on boys and mothers or men and mothers, but it was because it's been overlooked and made fun of that I did that. And I think about the queer population growing over the years. And I think about my grandmother's brother who was gay, and he helped pave the way for me as an individual in my family, but also for society. And then my generation has done the same for the next generation, and your generation does the same for the next generation, but we don't know it at the time that we're doing it. We're simply living our lives. So any impact that we can have, that I can have, is a great thing. On a total aside, sometimes I tell my clients that have queer nieces and nephews, you are a role model. You just don't know it. You know, we're so busy protecting ourselves and our families of origin from what we were seen as, that we don't think that we have much value. And yet our nieces and nephews are looking up to us as someone who has survived, and we're setting an example for people without even intending to.
That's so cool, Rick. Yeah, thank you for that. That's a really beautiful way to conclude our time too. I really am grateful for you being here and sharing about this project, and also for just lifting up the experiences of mothers.
Thank you.
And I hope that the listeners out there will check out gaysonsandmothers.org.
Please.
And find you on Instagram under the same name.
Yeah. Gay Sons and Mothers. Gay Sons and Mothers, all one word.
Yeah.
And thank you for having me here, Finn. It's great to see you.
Absolutely. Is there any other way that people can or should contact you, or are those the channels?
Sure. The other way to contact me is through my psychotherapy and business consulting website, rickmiller.biz. Rick Miller, all one word, .b as in boy, I, Z as in zebra. Rick Miller is such a common name that it was hard to find a domain name out there for myself.
I love it as biz. That's great.
Not too distinctive.
That's awesome. Well, thank you, Rick.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And that wraps up our hour. Be sure to tune into Outbeat Radio next Sunday night. Del Phoenix will be here, as it's the fifth Sunday. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCBFM Roanoke Park and KRCGFM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Le Jazz Hot is next.